Let's get rolling into hour number three tonight with Dr. Henry Nyman. We're going to bring you up to date on the weekend. We don't have all the numbers in. There's a little bit of a delay on Monday, but the numbers continue to go up. There's some really strange stories out there. Bill Gates and MIT have unveiled what they call a quantum dot technology to mark children's skin so they can be scanned for vaccine compliance, I guess, in the future, permanently. I didn't get the whole story digested, but you think about vaccines, they're talking about once a year or two shots in succession. I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to watch that one. Here are a couple of others. Another Utah hospital has filled its ICU with over 1,168 more cases reported today. A Texas woman died of coronavirus on the jetway on a flight from Arizona. And that raises a lot of questions. Rural Midwest hospitals struggling to handle coronavirus surge. It just exploded, said one spokesman, which Henry predicted and forecast some time ago. The former FDA chief has warned that the biggest wave of coronavirus is now on us, right now. This is not to say a second wave. He said, this guy's name is Dr. Scott Gottlieb, you may remember him. He said, we're probably in the seventh inning of the acute phase of this pandemic right now. No second wave here. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, shared grim predictions on Sunday as the nation battles surges of coronavirus infections without the benefit of a vaccine, which is obviously down the road. Henry, welcome back. How are you?
Well, it's good to be back. I'm busy. A lot going on. The pandemic is rocking and rolling. I kind of looking at it a little bit different than some of the media reports. They're talking about the third peak now, or some are talking about the third wave. But I have a feeling that few weeks from now, maybe a month from now, those curves will look quite a bit different. And it'll be really just two waves. The first wave was the one that started in the spring. Places where, you know, they kind of listen to the scientists and actually try to control the virus, they would have you know, what's called a herald wave, an initial wave in the spring that is kind of spotty, definitely is there, kind of gets under control, goes back down to baseline or low level over the summer, and then comes back with a vengeance in the fall. And that's kind of what's happening in Europe now. It's actually...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Going beyond that, it's in Russia. Russia's taken off. So they're starting to see big jumps now in cases. As the weather gets a little bit cooler, people spend more time inside. And this is kind of the pattern that's happened with the flu pandemics for the last 100 years. They all kind of follow that same pattern, that they show up in the spring, don't get that bad, then kind of fade, and then come back in the fall, and then are much worse in the fall than in the spring. The U.S., you know, basically didn't quite follow that pattern, that it never really went away. It had an outbreak in the spring, and then it kind of went down a little bit, but then it jumped back in the summer. The summer outbreak was mostly in the South. There's a lot of states down there that kind of locked down, and then they decided, well, it's time to unlock. You know, CDC put up guidelines that, you know, they should be showing decline in the number of cases before they kind of open things up again. And they either misrepresented the data, ignored the guidelines, or both. Most of them did both. And just opened up because Trump said, oh, it's over. Time to open up again. Let's try to get the schools open in the spring. Initially wanted the churches full by Easter, and was pushing real hard to open things up. Many of the states did open things up, and the virus came back. It probably the worst one initially was in Arizona, if you recall. That was the first one to kind of open things up.
Sure.
And then there were big numbers in Florida and Texas and actually in California also. Those were bigger states. And those numbers ran up, and they were reporting 10,000. Each of them were reporting like 10,000 cases a day. On a bad day, they could get as high as 15,000 cases. And the numbers went higher. So over the summer, they were actually higher than they were in the spring, and they got up to 60, 70,000 per day briefly. And then that one started to decline. Those three states that had the largest numbers started reporting numbers closer to 10,000 combined instead of 10,000 each. So instead of 30,000 for those three states, they were 10,000. And then some of the other states started picking up the balance. And right now, the outbreaks have been in less densely populated states. The states that are actually leading the country, I don't know, they might even be leading the world, and per capita cases are actually North and South Dakota, and they never really had much of a lockdown. As you recall, they had a big motorcycle event in August in Sturgis in South Dakota.
Right.
One study came out and actually followed cell phones and basically looked at what cell phones went into Sturgis and which cell phones went out of Sturgis right around, you know, correlating with the start of the bike festival and the end of the bike festival. And then they looked at the counties that those cell phones went to, and then compared those counties to comparable counties nearby, and saw dramatic increases, and actually estimated that about 20% of the COVID cases were linked to 20% of the COVID cases in the United States, in the entire country, mm-hmm. were linked to counties that received those cell phones from Sturgis. And so it was a huge effect, a huge surge. And now, not surprisingly, the two states with the largest increases are actually South Dakota and North Dakota. The other states that are right up there with them are also states that aren't that highly populated, but a per capita basis, you know, like Montana and Idaho, and they got Wisconsin and Minnesota and Utah now. And so these less populated states are just having explosions in cases. And those explosions, even though they're not that highly populated, are starting to have an effect on the total number of cases. And then the numbers are starting to go up in other states now. And the number got up to 70,000. On Friday. And I had said on Friday that it looked like the fall wave was actually beginning. And predicting the fall wave wasn't really that hard. You know, it basically, people go back to school, people go back to work, people are kind of do doing more interactions with other people, and infectious diseases like flu, and in this case, COVID, start to increase. And then it kind of increases at a certain rate, kind of below the radar, where you've got some people coming in. And in this case, it looks like a lot of this was driven by younger people who don't traditionally get as sick as the elderly population. And so they get infected. Some of them just transmit it asymptomatically. Others kind of get milder disease and don't get hospitalized. And others actually do get hospitalized, but they don't die. The death toll is not nearly as great as it is with, you know, 65 and older populations.
We have about 320 million Americans who have not officially been infected yet. So this thing there's no. How can we expect anything other than what you've been forecasting and what we're seeing? We've got an unlimited number of people for this virus to do what it does, and it's doing it.
There's no plan. There's no real effort. The plan is Scott Atlas's herd immunity plan, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an evolving story. Anthony Fauci was on 60 Minutes yesterday, and basically he got interviewed about how things were going, and he had said previously that, you know, he was hoping that the U.S. would get the number of cases down below 10,000 before they went into the fall, because he anticipated, as did most scientists, most virologists or epidemiologists. I don't know about radiologists. Radiologists may not have been as good at anticipating what was going to happen in the fall. Or vice presidents weren't that good. They were looking for the fall wave in the summer and kept saying, I don't see a second wave. And they didn't quite get the concept that it was going to happen in the fall. And June and July are not the fall.
we're going to have it's obvious this winter is going to be hellish in terms of numbers.
So that's why I'm saying that when you look back in a month or two, you're going to see what happened in the spring and the summer were really all part of the Herald wave that was very, very, very poorly controlled. So unlike Europe, where it kind of showed up in the spring and then kind of went down and got under control over the summer and now it's coming back, the U.S., it never went down. It went down a little bit, but it never went down to baseline. And then it went back up again because of no leadership. It's all up to the governors. The governor's trying to please the president, wanting to get everything opened up again. It disregarded advice from the scientists and just went ahead and opened things up and started spreading the virus and got it up to 70,000 when it should be down around, it should be around 700. It was 100 times higher than it should have been. And as a result, the U.S. has a big Herald wave with actually two peaks instead of just one peak. Instead of having in the spring going down, went down a little bit, then went back up over the summer. So the summer was actually the highest it's been. And that's all relative. The reason the summer was the highest was because of, no plan and just stupidity on the part. Governors aren't scientists, and if they don't listen to the scientists and listen to the Dr. Trump, they don't get the desired result. They end up taking a bad situation and make it much worse. And so Fauci would say, well, it'd be nice if we got the numbers below 10,000 before we go into the fall. And of course, instead of getting below 10,000, we got up to 70,000, and then it kind of dropped down to around 40,000. And he would say, well, 40,000 isn't really where you want to be going into the fall. And now the number is starting to go up. And so that kind of came up on 60 Minutes. And then they asked Fauci the key question. They said, well, did you expect the president to get infected? And his answer was, unfortunately, I actually did. It was when they had that that event at the Rose Garden, and I just saw all of those people there, very few wearing masks, very close packed when they were sitting for the
ceremony. Has that picture been updated, by the way? Has it been updated with any others who have become infected or tested positive? Other than that first picture, which you sent me, remember?
Oh yeah. That first picture I sent you, there were something like I think there were 7 or 8 people circled, and there's now 40 people that have been infected now, and not all of them were sitting in that picture. Some of them were reporters. Some of them were. Yeah, the president's son wasn't, I don't think he was in the pictures. You got Kellyanne Conway's daughter. She wasn't in the pictures. You got Scalia's son's wife. She actually was in the picture, but she wasn't circled. And so, there have been quite a few. There have been 40 people that have been confirmed now that were associated with the White House, and the vast majority of those 40 people were linked to that Rose Garden event. Not all of them, but probably the number that were in the Rose Garden was closer to, 25 or so, instead of the 6 or 8 that were circled when I sent you that picture.
Prior to the Rose Garden, was that not the first debate? Do I remember right? Wasn't the first debate before the Rose Garden?
No, it was right after. The Rose Garden was the weekend before the debate.
Oh, okay.
The debate, I believe, was on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And there were some that were doing debate prep that were at the Rose Garden and at the debate prep. Chris Christie was an example of that. He was at the Rose Garden and he was doing the debate prep, and he just got out of the hospital. So, so he wasn't circled in the picture I sent you initially. He developed symptoms a little bit later, and then he was in the hospital for the ICU, I think, and for about a week or so, and he just got out. They did show him meeting and greeting outside at the Rose Garden, and then the initial pictures didn't show the meeting and greeting inside. So in addition to the ceremony outside, where they didn't wear masks, they had additional groups that were meeting in inside, and they were in close quarters, and there would have been more transmission. So it's not clear that the people that were circled got infected while they were sitting where they were sitting for the picture. They had been standing, having drinks and hors d'oeuvres before they sat down, and then they had small breakout meetings afterwards. So there were many opportunities for those people to get infected. And then it was like the Wednesday after that weekend that the reports started coming in. Hope Hicks was positive. The head of the RNC was positive. I think she was positive on Tuesday, and Hope Hicks was symptomatic on Wednesday. And I think by Wednesday night, she had tested positive. And then And then the numbers kept going up. And I think I sent you that picture early the following week. So a lot of the people had not been diagnosed yet. And you know, they had the president from Notre Dame, and he had a contact, I think, that wasn't there. But that's why I thought that he might have been one of the people that was doing the infecting, because it seemed that he might have been infected before he ever got to the Rose Garden. But the bottom line was, it was, you know, they were really operating under a false sense of security. They were using this Abbott rapid test to screen everybody, and that test lacked sensitivity. I mean, that was noted as soon as they started talking about that test. Other scientists who had been doing PCRs that were, you know, taking 4 hours or so to get a result, would take samples that were positive on the PCR test and then run them through on the rapid test. And they were finding about half of the samples that were positive by PCR were negative on the rapid test. So it indicated that, you know, the sensitivity left a lot to be desired. And therefore, a lot of people who were infected would have tested negative. So the fact they came to the Rose Garden and they tested negative on the rapid test didn't mean they weren't positive. I mean, Hope Hicks actually had been tested Wednesday morning on the rapid test, and she was negative, and she was symptomatic by Wednesday evening and quarantined herself on the President's Air Force One coming back from, I think they went to Minnesota for a rally. So she was coming back from that and then self-isolated and then tested positive either Wednesday night or Thursday morning. But she clearly had virus on Wednesday morning, you know, the morning that she became symptomatic, but she was tested and was negative. And the same thing happened to Stephen Miller's wife, that she was tested negative, and she had a cough, and she told reporters it wasn't COVID, and the reason she was confident it wasn't COVID is she had just been tested. And then her symptoms got worse, and like the next day she got tested again and was positive. So that was another example that less than 24 hours before she was symptomatic, she was tested on this rapid test, and the rapid test that she was negative, and the viral RNA levels are generally the highest 1 or 2 days before the onset of symptoms. So both of them should have had a pretty high level of viral RNA when they tested negative on that test. And that's what they were relying upon. That's what Trump was relying on, saying he didn't need to wear the mask. He gets tested all the time. He's negative. Mm-hmm. He's not infected. But then that whole issue came up as to when he was tested after he was positive. You know, it was, when was your last negative test? And he's never answered that question. His physicians have never answered that question. And even a direct question saying, well, had you tested negative when you went to the debate, the first debate, which was on a Tuesday, and that required that you had been tested within 72 hours of the debate and tested negative. And he was asked if he was tested. He didn't get tested by the Cleveland Clinic, who was doing the testing, because he arrived late and kind of waved it off and said, you know, he didn't need to be tested. You know, he gets tested all the time. So they didn't test him, and he was almost certainly infected at the debate because he was symptomatic.
I think there's a little doubt about that. I agree. Late
the next day, and then with the rapid test, I think, and then he was confirmed with the PCR test, and he tweeted that out like on Friday morning, I guess it was. But
I've asked you a bunch of times what happened to Katie Miller, Pence's press secretary.
Yeah, and she's kind of out and about again. She's back at work.
She's back at work. Yeah, she went back to work, and there was virtually no notice of it. She went back to work on May 26th, and I never saw a word about it. Kayleigh McEnany is apparently testing negative now, and she wants to go back to work. So that's I never knew.
She
went back too.
She was back at work, and she still didn't wear a mask. And that reporter still complained that they were going, and he had been positive, and she didn't wear a mask when they had their press briefings, and after she got infected, and may have infected some or all of the four reporters, the White House reporters that were positive, and that led to additional dependence of those reporters that were positive. But exactly who infected them wasn't clear. They weren't all at the Rose Garden, but they were confirmed, and I think they did, you know, have interactions with her. And but then Stephen Miller got infected, you know, but he probably got infected during this debate prep. I think most of the people in the debate prep ended up being infected, and whether they were infected by the president, I don't know. That would seem like it would be a distinct possibility, because I think they were in a fairly small room and getting ready for the debate, and that would have been after the Rose Garden. But in any event, getting back to the pandemic, the Rose Garden was a little while ago. I mean, Trump's already recovered from that. He's out and about on his rallies, so he's doing multiple rallies each day, and he's, again, yeah, I've mentioned this before, but it's worse now because he's doing some of the rallies in some of these hard-hit states. I mean, he's doing rallies in Wisconsin, doing rallies in Michigan, and they're all pretty much the same thing. Most of them are outside at an airport hangar or airport runway, and they got, you know, some stand set up. And the attendees are literally shoulder to shoulder. They kind of get the one standing behind the president to wear masks, or at least a relatively high percentage of them. So when the TV cameras take pictures of Trump delivering his speech, they show that most of the people behind him are wearing masks, but virtually none of the people in front of him are wearing masks. And there's a lot more in front of him than behind him. Behind him, there's usually a relatively small stand that had enough people to fill up the screen for the TV shots of Trump. But the majority of the people, attendees, are in front of Trump, and the vast majority of them are not wearing masks. And so he's creating these, you know, one or two or three super spreader, you know, events per day now. He's ignoring the fact that his fans are, you know, they're obviously getting infected. I mean, they may not be coughing in his face, and they may not be, you know, confirmed yet, but they're packed in very tight there, and, you know, they're there for an hour or two packed in, and they're drifting around before that.
Is it fair to say that there's no real logical way to stop this virus from eventually running through everybody? It's too late.
No, it's way too late. No, what's remarkable about the virus is that it actually is controllable. I mean, the city that had the worst outbreak was New York. New York, you know, literally had tens of thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands. I think they're up to 400,000 cases.
Well, what I should say is that wasn't my real question.
The real question.
Hold on, let me get this.
Control.
Okay, yes, and you covered that. We covered it here. The question is, and I should have been more articulate, the variety of ways of either dealing with control or opening things up across the country, red state, blue state, is going to make it, in all likelihood, that this virus is going to have a rather long run. That's the question, I guess, or the comment.
Right.
We're not getting uniform. Yeah.
Well, what most scientists will say is that there are vaccines that are under development, and you know, some of them think that they're going to be ready for approval, probably not before the election, but probably before the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And then the warp speed, they've been you know, developing these vaccines, you know, producing these vaccines. So once one is approved or more approved, then they would start distributing them, and they would start uh-huh. distributing to the first responders and the more elderly patients that are most vulnerable. And the idea is that the vaccine will create the herd immunity, that the people will have some immunity because of the vaccine for those that get infected in spite of being vaccinated will tend to have a milder course so that they'll bolster their immunity that wasn't that high because of the vaccine, but got higher because they got infected. But because they had the vaccine, they had kind of a head start on the virus, and they didn't get as sick, or they didn't have as many, you know, events that may lead to some type of temporary or permanent injury, and so that mm-hmm. those types of injuries will be lower, and that the population will, you know, get immunity in a more controlled manner. Some of them will be lucky enough to get enough immunity from the vaccine that they won't get infected. Or if they do get infected, it'll be asymptomatic and they'll kind of get their immunity higher, but they won't end up in the hospital. They won't end up dying. And the damage will be milder than it would be if they didn't have any immunity, if they were just kind of starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. And the concept is that if you can kind of control the spread of the virus, and the masks do seem to be able to control the spread. They don't mean that nobody wearing a mask is going to get infected, especially since a lot of the people who are wearing masks are either doing cloth masks, which are better than some of these bandanas that are very thin. The bandanas probably aren't doing a whole lot of anything. The cloth masks that have multiple layers are probably doing more. The N95s are doing even more than that. You know, ideally, everybody would have an N95.
How about a K? Let me ask again. I've gotten emails. What about KN95s? That means Korea, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think the...
You read anything about them?
Yeah, the specifications aren't quite as high. Instead of, they're not really 95. I think they're like 70% or something. So they're... They're better than a bandana or a scarf. Uh-huh. They're not as good as the N95 without the K. And the K N95s, I think, are more available. And I don't know, they might cost a little bit less. And there's never really been an effort to get the production of the regular N95s up to a level where they could up the recommendations. I mean, that was the problem from the beginning. From the beginning, the masks weren't recommended. And one of the main reasons the masks weren't recommended is because there was a shortage. And they were afraid that if they said you should wear a mask, everybody would run out and gobble up all the supplies, and then the first responders who needed the mask the most, they were treating patients, and they were in close quarters, wouldn't be able to get N95s, and then they would have a problem where more first responders or healthcare workers would be infected treating patients, and then they would be reluctant to do that. They would complain that, you know, we're on the front line, we're battling this virus day in and day out, and we can't even get N95 mask, which used to cost, you know, 70 cents or something, or a dollar or something.
Yeah.
And they can't even get a dollar mask. And, you know, the pandemic's here, and the government should have been aware of it and should have made preparations. And speaking of which, I mean, it wasn't like the virus started in the U.S. The virus did start in China. And there were rumors in December that there was an outbreak, and the outbreak itself was reported. There was some uncertainty as to what was causing the outbreak, but the fact that they had people at the seafood market that developed these pneumonias, and it was kind of like atypical pneumonia, and there were rumors that it was a SARS-like virus. Those rumors persisted for about a couple of weeks. You know, it kind of started the middle of December. By the end of December,
sure.
They were talking about a partial sequence and that it was a novel SARS coronavirus. And that was the red flag that, well, there was an outbreak. It was at a wet market. Quite a few people were involved, and several of them developed severe pneumonia, and several of them had already died. And then a week into January, I think it was January 8th, the full sequence was released. So
that's the day we did our first program on this, January
right,
the 8th.
Right. And at that point, anybody paying attention would know that there was a problem, because this was a novel SARS coronavirus. You could take that sequence and compare it to all the sequences in GeneBank, and it would take 10 seconds to get a result. It would show you what the top matches were, and all of the top matches were the SARS coronavirus from 17 years earlier, from 2002, 2003. And it reacted with the human ones. It reacted to ones in the civet cats. It reacted with the ones in the second outbreak that happened at the end of 2003. And it was clear that it was, you know, most closely related to that SARS coronavirus. And then if you looked at it closely, you would see that it not only was similar to that virus, but it had a polybasic cleavage site. And it had the basic amino, the configuration of basic amino acids that would make it a target of the protease furin. And furin was a well-known protease. It was very widespread. And therefore this virus would be able to infect a whole variety of cells. It wouldn't be limited to the upper respiratory tract like a cold or a flu virus was. That it could attack your heart. It could attack your lungs. It could attack your liver. It could attack a whole bunch of different organs. It could attack your brain. It was a very dangerous virus. It was the type of virus that you didn't want to say, oh, let's see what happens. You know, we need to get some herd immunity here. So let's everybody get infected and see how sick you get. You know, it was already killing people at the seafood market. It was already clear that it had a relatively high case fatality rate. It was on the same order of SARS. If you did the definition the same with SARS, you know, to have a case, which is used to develop the case fatality rate, you had to have pneumonia, you had to be hospitalized, and if you met that criteria, overall, about 20% of the people would die that met that criteria. And that percentage was even higher for those that were over 65. It had the same type of age distribution that SARS-CoV-2 had. It was exactly the same. There were a lot of similarities as far as who is at risk, what underlying conditions put you at risk. And so Trump knew that there was a problem, and he knew there was a problem in January. It wasn't like, you know, oh, it's in China. I wonder what that is. What's going on over there? And if he had any doubt as to how bad it was in China and how much were they covering it up, it wasn't really that bad. As soon as they started exporting cases, they knew how bad it was. And the study came out of England, and they wrote it up because they had one case in Thailand, and they had one case in Japan. And I said, well, if you already got two cases, not that many people are flying to Thailand and Japan from Wuhan. You know, Wuhan's not on the coast. It's quite a bit inland. And there aren't that many flights. And if you've got a couple cases that are showing up there, and you've got a population of 19 million, that to get a couple exported, and by the time they wrote the paper, they already had a third one, so they have three exported. They knew that there were tens of thousands of cases. And if there were tens of thousands of cases, it wasn't from a wet market, which would cause, you know, dozens of cases. It was human to human transmission. So it didn't really matter if China said we have no evidence mm-hmm. of doesn't mean anything. That's negative mm-hmm. data. That's mm-hmm. because you haven't tried hard enough. And it mm-hmm. doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means you haven't got the conclusive data. But if you can do math, you know that if you got tens of thousands of cases, that it's not, you know, everybody's not eating fish at that fish market. They don't have that many customers that can get 10,000 people infected that quickly.
No,
the only way
chance.
You're going to get 10,000 people infected is that human to human transmit. Right. And so all of this was known back in December. Actually, it was all known in January. It was suspected in December. It was known in January. And that's why these, you know, pseudo, you know, limitations on Chinese nationals coming to the U.S. I mean, the virus would have come over Christmas break. I mean, that's when you'd have all the travel. If you wanted the virus flying into the U.S. from China, you would have students that went back home over Christmas break and came back to the U.S. in January. And so they would be back in the U.S. before you even knew there was a problem or before you knew the extent of the problem.
No.
So,
the actions taken by this administration were indefensible, given what was on the table. I don't care if Jerry Kushner convinced Donald that don't worry about it, just play it light.
That was the early excuse.
Donald,
yeah, but he's on tape. He's on tape with Woodward. Woodward had him on tape in January saying uh-huh. how he did, he wanted to play down the severity. He already knew that it was five times deadlier than the flu. He already knew it transmitted human to human. He already knew it transmitted through the air. And he said, well, he went and he was acting as a cheerleader. He was trying to cheer on the American public. He didn't want them to worry their pretty little heads. And he was trying to tell them, don't worry about it. There's only one case. We got this under control. And while he was telling the public how in control it was, they were telling their buddies, you know, you better start shorting your stock because this is a big problem. The stock market's not going to do well. And that was his message right. in January. It's on tape. It's not like, honestly, for me,
the biggest disappointment was when he invoked the Defense Production Act and didn't use it. That was unforgivable to me. That really bothered me a lot.
Plus, he didn't want blame, so he said it was all, you know, up to the state. Each state had to go and figure out how they were going to handle it. And then each state had to figure out how they were going to get their PPEs. And then if they weren't careful and got the PPEs, he would go and send Homeland Security to confiscate them and give them to whoever he wanted to give them to. It was a mess. And then the whole thing with the mask, and to say that the mask was controversial. And now it's moved up a notch, because now, since Fauci said, well, I knew that that Rose Garden event was a super spreader event. I just kind of covered my eyes and said, I can't believe they're doing this. And then it turned out it was a super spreader event. Well, that was kind of like, declaring war as far as Trump was concerned. I mean, he spent all day berating Fauci and saying he's an idiot and the scientists are idiots. And if we listen to the idiots, we'd be in a depression now. And he went on and on, and he started denouncing Biden for listening to the scientists. So, you know, I have said this a long time ago, that the Trump is basically anti-science. I mean, he's had issues with science. He doesn't understand science. He thinks he does. He doesn't really know what he doesn't know how dumb he is. I mean, he's the guy that wants to use Lysol and ultraviolet light after he hears reports on how they kill the virus on surfaces, and he thinks, well, he should be able to do that in human beings. And the report
that was a shocker. I agree.
Right. And then so now he's basically anti-science. He's not taking any advice from group. You know, he's got
his task force.
His task force, right. His task force, all he's listened to is Scott Atlas. Scott Atlas, who's a retired radiologist, no training in infectious disease, no training in virology, doesn't know he'd be hard-pressed to say what a sequence was. He doesn't really know how viruses evolve. And he doesn't understand herd immunity. I mean, the whole concept of herd immunity is that you get your herd immunity through a vaccine. That's the reason they're spending all this money and they're making the vaccines before they're approved, so that as soon as one of them gets approved, they can start distributing it and they can start immunizing people. And that substitutes for the herd immunity. They get immunity, but they get it with a vaccine that doesn't have a live virus. It's not going to normally, create the same types of problems that you're going to get if you get infected with a virus. And it's not going to be transmissible, so that it's not going to have the problem that even if you don't get sick, you're not going to be acting as a vector to move that virus around and infect your family members or your work employees' contacts or whoever you go to a birthday party or go to a bar. You're not going to spread the virus, but you're going to spread a vaccine, and the population is going to develop herd immunity, and that it'll either prevent you from getting infected or it'll create a milder infection, and that will produce more herd immunity. But it will be under conditions where the likelihood that you die or the likelihood that you have a permanent injury is significantly lower. The likelihood that you'll overwhelm the health delivery system so that the next person coming in isn't going to be treated because the doctors are overwhelmed and they have patients that need to go on ventilators, but they don't have time to fine tune it, and they end up putting them on the ventilators and they end up dying anyway because it isn't really individualized. So instead they've got Scott Atlas, who's basically come up with this herd immunity, and they'll protect the elderly in nursing homes and they'll let everybody else just do what they want. And that he's presenting this, he's deploying this when the fall wave is just getting going. And so over the weekend, the numbers generally go down. They were a little bit bumpy because some of the sites weren't reporting the data. They reported some of the data the day they didn't do over the over the weekend. And as a result, there were almost 50,000 cases today. And today is really Sunday's result. Monday is really a weekend result. Generally, Saturday, Sunday, right, and Monday are the right lowest days. There were almost 60,000 today. There were 43,000 yesterday. There were over 50,000 on Saturday. And my projection is that this week, the U.S. will set an all-time high. I think the all-time high is 77,000 in one day. And like I said, they got up to 69,000 on Friday. I think that by the end of this week, they'll break that 77,000. They'll probably get up to 80,000. And that by next week, they'll probably get up to 90 or 100,000.
We're
within
headed
a
toward,
couple of weeks,
yeah,
they'll be at 100,000. And that's just an all-time high. It is kind of a milestone. That's not the upper limit. I'm not saying that they'll get up to 100,000 and that's it. They're going to get up to 100,000 in the next couple of weeks, and this isn't going to be going down anytime soon. It's going to go from the fall into the winter. There'll be people, you know, coming.
It's going to be a very difficult winter for a lot of reasons.
Christmas,
that's going to be bad.
There's a holiday season. Yeah. There's Thanksgiving before that, and it's going to be a disaster.
So, I agree.
Anyway,
I agree. All right, thank you, Henry.
Stand. Okay, right. I'll get an update by the end of the week or so, and you'll see where we stand.
Excellent.
Okay, take care.
Thanks for the good work. Okay. Good night.
Okay. Bye bye.
Okay. There we are, off and running on a Monday. Be back with you tomorrow night on Tuesday. And wow, it's going to be tough this winter. So beware. Talk to you soon. Thanks for being here.